House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:22 on April 11th. With us today are Representative Herron, Representative Reinbold, Representative Josephson, and myself, Chair Olson. We have one excused absence, and Speaker Chenault, Representative Sadler are on their way. So we do have a quorum. Please turn off your cell phones. We're going to be buying us bagels, which we really need. I'm sure we all look like we're starving. But first item on the calendar is House Bill 346, Public Benefits Corporation. And with us today is the sponsor, Paul Seaton and Tanika Hansen. Are you just sitting there? Are you going to be... welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I'd like to add before we get started that... The sponsor has brought forward a blank CS, which is in your packet. I would entertain a motion to adopt the CS.
Mr. Chairman, I move CSHB 346 version O as the working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion, and welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you like me to just go through the bill?
Like you read yourself onto the record.
Oh, Representative Paul Seaton, Southern Kenai Peninsula and Homer.
And the inside joke is we sit next to each other. We know who we are on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 346 is increasing the options for Alaskan entrepreneurs and investors by establishing a new corporate entity. That's the Benefit Corporation, or B Corp for short. Existing corporate structures in Alaska, the C Corporation, especially provide numerous benefits and jobs. However, 346 would add another type, which is that B Corporation, as a for-profit corporation which incorporates public benefits and community improvement into its business practices. The current corporate law generally leads a corporation to consider only the financial impact to stockholders as their top priority in making decisions. Yeah, 100 years ago, we had a legal decision called Dodge versus Ford in Michigan, and it said a business corporation is organized and carried on primarily for the profit of the stockholders. The powers of the directors are to be employed to that end. The discretion of directors is exercised in the choice of the means to attain that end and does not extend to the change in the end itself, to the reduction of profits, or to the non-distribution of profits among stockholders in order to devote them to other purposes. So, Mr. Chairman, the whole idea is that in a C corporation, the goal is exclusively making money for shareholders. And there's nothing wrong with that, but if a corporation wants to have other goals within its community, then it could be legally liable to shareholder suits or something, because those community involvement must have some nexus to corporate profit. Under the B Corp structure, owners and boards are able to take actions which positively impact their communities without fear of violating that fiduciary duty, and it gives corporate owners and investors more flexibility. HB 346 will give business owners more choice in how to run their business and will bring Alaska a slice of that $3.7 trillion that is invested nationwide in socially responsible funds. B corporations are formed voluntarily, and they have the same tax status as any other for-profit corporation. So there's no tax advantage in being a B corporation. They can participate in tax credits, but only to the extent that a other corporation could do that as well. We have 23 states that have now enacted B corporation statutes, and West Virginia, Utah, and Nebraska have just done that this year. And this legislation is not exactly model legislation, but we took from several of those other states the parts, because if the legislation is similar, then investors have an easier time tracking and knowing and being able to see and attract investment into Alaska. We've got over 550 benefit corporations incorporated in the United States, everything from Patagonia in California to Rasmussen College, Epic Coffee, and King Arthur Flour, which is the oldest flour company in the United States. And each of these companies works for benefits for the public and their communities in ways that matter most to them. They get to make those decisions. There's no decision being made by the state on what that public benefit will be. They are required to make an annual report, a benefit report, and they can have a benefit director that is in charge of some of those things. And so these benefit reports give the same thing as general accounting principles, let the public see the corporate finances in a way that everybody can understand. So the goal of the HB 346 is to give businesses flexibility and control over decisions and to provide private investors with a clear social investment option. And this bill was brought to us by several Alaskans that looked at this, and especially Diane Hughes, owner of Earth Friendly Coffee in Homer. And there's a letter of support in your packet from her. And Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to approach the bill any way you'd like. If you want to go through a sectional, that's we could do that. You've had the bill for a while, but if you
yeah, I think we've
do that.
Had long enough to read, but we've been joined by Representative Chenault, Speaker Chenault.
You got me too, right?
First question for Representative Seaton. Andy?
I can try one. thank you, through the chair. Representative Seaton, there's a company that I did some investing through called Calvert, and the investor sort of knows up front that his or her returns may be less than they would otherwise with, say, a mutual fund. Is that how the shareholders approach this? Do they anticipate making perhaps a little bit less but doing some good with it? Is that sort of the idea, or?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, yes, the shareholders know what the public benefit or specific benefit is that has been voted on by the directors and incorporated into the corporation. So the people that invest in these corporations generally share the same kind of philosophy that it's not just about maximizing dollars, but they share that public benefit goal, whether it's education or research or whatever that goal is specified.
Do you follow? Yes. Do you know, Representative Seaton, whether there's any discussion of sort of the treatment of workers in third world countries, that type of issue? You know, there was a big debate about Old Navy and Gap and an explanation recently after a fire or something about why we pay so little for our clothing. Is there any discussion of treatment of third world workers in any of it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Joseph, there can be, depending upon what the public benefit that is selected by the corporation as they see as their duty and what they want to support, whether it's more local farm jobs instead of cheaper buying groceries from another place. That is would be a benefit that is adopted in a particular corporation, and people could invest in that corporation because they want to promote local food and local jobs, whereas it would be cheaper to buy those products and have them shipped in. So in the typical C corporation structure, it's difficult because that is not a fiduciary choice. And in the case of Revlon, that's exactly what the Delaware and other case laws said is has made it clear that directors' only duty is to maximize shareholder value by securing the highest bid available. That's where you're bidding products, and even though you get a community benefit, you know, it's hard to take that because your job as a director is just to maximize profit. So this allows those kinds of benefits to be selected as one of the criteria that they'll use.
And for the record, this is Tanika Hansen, staff to Representative Seaton. Representative Justin, through the chair. There are two parts of the benefit corporation. There's the general public benefit purpose and the specific public benefit purpose. So all benefit corporations, if once they voluntarily take on this classification, have that general public benefit purpose, which is listed on page 4. There's a list of 7 things that the directors must consider as they're making the decisions, and they weight them as they choose, but they must consider those 7. And one is the community and societal factors, including the interests of each community in which the offices or facilities of the benefit corporation, its subsidiaries, or its suppliers are located. So that's definitely the specifics that you mentioned is something that these benefit corporations look at. And the third-party standard that they hold their benefit report up against will have questions relating to that since it's one of the general public benefit purposes.
Thank you.
Any further questions for the sponsor? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Briefly, I'm just trying to get a sense, Mr. Representative Seaton, if this is aimed primarily at existing businesses to convert to this new structure, or is it aimed at more likely being new corporations, new business ventures will take this form?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it can be either. I mean, there are a number of businesses existing that want to do things locally, but they have they're on this horns of the dilemma because they really don't want to violate their primary duty, which is making the maximum amount of dollars for their shareholders. And so this allows them, with a two-thirds vote, to take on, become a B corporation and establish specific benefit. And, you know, that gets publicized, and so people can invest based on that. But it also allows the flexibility for new corporations as well. I could give you some examples, small tour companies that are making tours and are hiring people that are local that give color, flavor to the ethnic kinds of tours that are being given, but may not make the same kind of financial sense.
Just kind of probe, my impression just in the background material is this is primarily focused at companies that are publicly traded, and there's the obligation of corporate boards to their shareholders. How many businesses in Alaska actually are publicly traded? And I guess is the implication that this only applies to publicly traded corporations, or is it smaller corporations as well?
Through the chair, Representative Adler, it can be smaller corporations as well, and the division of corporations is here, and they can answer how many corporations there are in the state. I don't know, I have that number.
Okay. Any further questions? With that, I'm going to lift my objection to adopting the SAS as the working document. Is there any further objection? Seeing none, /O is adopted as the working document. I think I'll open it up to the public now. Thank you, Representative Seaton. And in the room, we have Gordon Blue signed up. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and tell us what you think of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Gordon Blue. I'm here as the Executive Director of the Alaska Sustainable Fisheries Trust today, and I'd like to speak in support of the bill. The Alaska Sustainable Fisheries Trust has a mission which is designed to increase the retention of the benefits of the fisheries in Gulf of Alaska communities. We have 3 projects to that end. One of those projects is a modeled on community-supported agriculture. It's called Alaskan Zone. It's a community-supported fishery project in which local fishermen, local processors produce product for us to sell to local consumers. It's primarily an educational venture, but it also produces a little bit of net proceeds, which are shared back to a second project, which is our community Fisheries Conservation Network, and that network is a collaboration of scientists and fishermen to solve some of the problems that come up in the fisheries, such as reduction of unwanted bycatch. That's been very successful. Our third project, which we're trying to get off the ground, we call Local Fish Fund. Local Fish Fund is designed to try to increase the retention of fishery quota in halibut sable fish fisheries in the communities of the Gulf. And you know that there have been several attempts through financing mechanisms. This is a further articulation on that to try to bring some success to it, because we're still losing quota to the outside. The essence of the idea is that the Local Fish Fund will provide a vehicle for fishermen who are about to retire from the fisheries to make an intergenerational transfer quota to a new fisherman who has made a commitment to stay in the community, which increases the take of the community and the proceeds from the fisheries. That is complicated by the regulations governing the halibut and sable fish fisheries, and we have worked with some pretty high-priced and talented attorneys to lay out an arrangement that will accomplish this, and we've created a subsidiary, if you will, of the nonprofit Alaska Sustainable Fisheries Trust, which is called Local Fish LLC. That agreement in the LLC allows us to balance the interests of participants in the LLC, which includes fishermen who are about to retire and would like to sell their quota on a time contract, and fishermen that we have qualified to come into the fisheries who would like to purchase that quota, and it provides the financing to pay the taxes that are generated by that transaction, which is a fairly high toll for those who are original recipients of quota. The agreement works in essence legally, but it's very complicated, and over time, if we succeed in increasing the size of the business so that it will really have an impact and make the improvements we hope to, the social benefits we hope to bring, it becomes difficult to administer those LLC membership interests and to describe accurately and clearly to the participants what their interest is from time to time. A B corporation would suit us very admirably. Would allow us to use that corporate stock structure to keep a clear statement of the interests of the participants that's easy to transfer, easy to understand, and yet would allow us to continue our public benefits, which are, of course, the interest of the nonprofit in doing this. I would direct you to the discussion of the LLC in the final part of the bill. There's an addendum supporting documentation. You might just add my comments to that statement about why this can't be done by an LLC. It can indeed. It's just very, very complex. And the savings in the administration cost would be significant to the organization. It would be to the benefit of the whole community, not to mention the necessity to publish a report every year on the public benefits. So we support the bill strongly. Thank you.
Excellent. Any questions for Mr. Blue? Thanks again for joining us today. Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we have at least one person that has called in. Eric Trojan?
Yes, thank you, Chairman. Hello, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Eric Trojan. I'm Director of Policy for nonprofit called B-Lab, which we were the ones who created the concept of the benefit corporation, and we very much appreciate the Alaskan legislature taking this concept up. And I think the sponsor did a wonderful job describing the bill, probably the best I've ever seen in his description of what the bill is doing and the like. As he had mentioned, 23 states across the country have passed it, mostly just in the past 3 years, and mostly within the last 2 years, there are now 550 benefit corporations and constantly growing. I think the key thing to think about here, not to reiterate what everybody has said, is that the purpose of a benefit corporation is to deregulate the purpose of a corporation, because as the sponsor had mentioned, the purpose of a corporation is extremely regulated. If I can only do one thing and one thing only, we've inhibited the free market from truly acting as a free market. And so by opening this up, we're allowing entrepreneurs to come up with new innovative ways to run a company, which will ultimately expand the marketplace, because we will have new ways of thinking about how a company is run. Right now, we're kind of stymied in our way of how we think corporations should be run and businesses should be run because we've had very set rules on that. And as so, we're now allowed to think of alternative ideas. And as the last gentleman had indicated in regards to why he would like it in the LLC, I think that's a very good point, because an LLC is based off of contract law, and it's formulated with numerous contracts, which is not a good vessel for multiple shareholders and is not structured as such. And also, when a business wishes to go public, which at this point in time, none of the benefit corporations across the country are public. There tend to be small to medium-sized companies. But as they wish to go public, they're in a quandary where if I have a particular social mission, I have to either, and I'm usually structured as an LLC, I usually have to deviate from that mission in order to bring in investors to then grow, or I have to stagnate my growth and not grow, which, of course, is not great for the economy. In addition, there's an accounting of $3.7 trillion, with a T, dollars of social impact investment money in the marketplace, as the one representative had mentioned about Calvert and the like. So there's $3.7 trillion of that money out there that's being targeted towards companies like this. And by opening this up, we now have a stage that investors and entrepreneurs can operate on. Because right now, not only is this a good thing to protect directors, it's a great thing to protect shareholders as well. Because right now, if I invest in a company that I believe has a particular social mission that I enjoy, they can deviate from that mission at any point in time, because we do not have a legally binding contract, because under law, the purpose of the corporation is to maximize profit, and that's perfectly fine, except if my understanding was that the company was going to do something else. So it really fills that gap in there. And as the sponsor had mentioned, the other key element of this is that it stays fairly consistent with the model legislation. Each state has their own, particular nuances, but the general concept is very consistent, which would attract investors, that they know what this means, what it means to invest in a benefit corporation, so it's a much easier vessel for those people to go into. And then I think lastly, I think it would be important to indicate that the younger generation, as they're growing into getting jobs and the like, we've seen numbers showing that about 80% of college graduates really want to work for companies that have particular missions. They feel that it's not only an issue of going to work to earn money, but it's a part of being part of society and wanting to have that connection. So this is another way, and we've seen this with a lot of other states that have done this, is a way to keep your younger population within your state and prevent them from going to other states that have other opportunities by expanding possible opportunities for these young employees and also young entrepreneurs to come up with new innovative ideas. And as the sponsor had indicated, there's no tax preference. You're treated as a C corp or S corp, and you're taxed just the same. And in fact, some states have actually seen this as a great opportunity to allow. This was in South Carolina. Representative Tommy Stringer there, who was the sponsor there, saw this as George H. Bush's 1,000 points of light kind of concept, where businesses are trying to try and alleviate problems in our society, because we don't have enough tax money in the world to solve all of society's problems. So why not harness this great power of the free market to try and solve problems that they see out there? The other unique part of the legislation is it does not dictate what is good for society. That is left up to the free market, again, as the sponsor had indicated. So if I want to be a conservative company and bestow my conservative values, I can do that. Same thing with my liberal values. It doesn't. That would be determined by the marketplace and the entrepreneur who's running the company. If they have a wise and good idea, then it will attract investors. It will attract consumers. But it's not the legislature that's dictating what is good for society. It is up to the free market to dictate that, and it just runs, provides the stage for them all to operate. So I'd like to thank you very much, and I'd entertain any questions that anybody has.
Representative Heron.
Thank you. I was hoping that you could give an example. If this is this constituency or constituent statute is passed, how would we enforce these rights?
Yes, Chairman, through the chairman, representative. This is all enforced the same way a traditional corporation enforces its duties of maximizing profit. It's enforced through the shareholders. It is not government that would sue a company for not maximizing profit. So the same principles were taking place here in that it's up to the shareholders. It's really allowing a contractual agreement through statute that the shareholders and the board of directors can entertain this issue. And again, it's forced through a benefit enforcement proceeding, which the shareholders are the only people with a private right of action there. It's not any other group. So it's not, let's say, you wanted to consider a particular aspect of your community, and you, even if you wrote that into your article, the people from the community can't sue the company for not achieving what they wanted to do. It would be up to the shareholders. But the shareholders can add, and it takes two-thirds vote, so quite a high vote, they can add particular outside interests who would have, part of that private right of action. But that would be up to the company whether they wish to add them or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Thanks again, Mr. Trojan, and it looks like it's about dinner time for you, isn't it?
It is, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak before you.
No, and thanks for making the effort to call in today. And is there anybody else online? Seeing none, I'll close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee. What is the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I think this is a good bill, and I think that it's well considered, and I like the concept of deregulating corporations. It's an interesting thing that isn't thought of very often, so I'm hopeful that the bill will move today.
I think it'll probably move in about 2 minutes. Any further comments? I was wrong, 1 minute. What is the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move CSHB 346 version /O from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objections, I will move the bill out of committee. Brief at ease. On the record, next item on the calendar today is Senate Bill 129, extend the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers. With us presenting the bill is Tally Teal from Senator Faircloth's office. And I believe this is the first time you've been before the committee, isn't it?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Well, welcome, and I think Erica says to say hello. But
thank you. I appreciate that. Just for the record, my name is Tally Teal. I am staff to Senator Faircloth. As you can see, she's not with us today. She is on the floor, and she does send her apologies to the committee. Before you today, you have the CS for Senate Bill 129, and in its original version, SB 129 was just a sunset bill that extended the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers for another 4 years. However, the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development approached us with some additional changes that must be made for this board to remain in compliance with a few new federal requirements that are laid out in the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, which amends Title 11 of the Financial Institutions Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act of 1989. Section 1 deals with the extension of the board that is the original bill. An audit completed last June by the Division of Legislative Budget and Audit recommended that the board be extended until June 30th, 2018. This four-year extension is half of the eight-year maximum allowed in statute. The shortened extension period is because of the projected increase in federally mandated responsibilities over the next few years. And the remaining sections are designed to bring the board into compliance with those changes. I can go through those changes if you like.
No, I think we've had a chance.
All right, then you can go straight to questions if there are any.
No questions on the fiscal note. Anybody have any questions on the fiscal note? Anybody have any questions for Tally on the bill? Seeing none, you got off real light.
Great.
It's a good time of year to have a bill.
Indeed.
And we also, I'm moving too fast for you guys, aren't I?
Yeah.
We do have Sarah Chambers from DCCED in the room for questions. We also have Chris Curtis, legislative auditor here, who does want to testify. Thanks again, Tally. Come on up, Chris. Welcome back.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I represent the Division of Legislative Audit. Our agency did conduct a sunset audit. The Board of Real Estate Appraisers, the report is dated June of 2013. Purpose of the audit was to examine whether the board was serving the public's interest in whether its termination date should be extended. Overall, we did conclude that the board is protecting the public's interest by effectively licensing and regulating real estate appraisers. The audit recommends the board's termination date be extended 4 years, which is half of the 8-year maximum. And again, as Tally explained, that was due to in recognition of the increase in the board's responsibilities mandated by the federal government. We believe it's prudent to come in a bit earlier than 8 years to examine the board in its different responsibilities. The audit makes two recommendations for operational improvements. Neither of these recommendations are directed to the board itself, but rather to the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. If you're looking at the audit, these begin on page 13. One recommendation is to improve administrative support to the board, including addressing investigative delays. And the second recommendation is to the DCBPL's director to continue improvements to the investigative case management system. The board and the department agreed with the recommendations.
I was going to make some comments on legislative audit, but I look around the room. I recognize just about every face in here, and I think your people in the room probably know more about ledge audit, like Speaker Chenault and Bob Heron, than I do, so I don't think we'll go into that. But are there any questions for Chris?
Sure. Through the chair, Ms. Curtis, the second recommendation relative to the DCBPL, that's a problem we're seeing across the board, in a number of different boards and commissions, not just this one, right?
Through the chair, the second recommendation in the audit itself is actually to improve administrative support. But I did testify, the order I testified, it had to do with the improving investigative case management. And yes, as I testified earlier before this committee, that is a division-wide issue as far as needing to improve the investigative case management system.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Chris? Thanks again. With that, I will open it up to public testimony. Is anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, anybody online? Public testimony closed. Back to the committee. Comments or motions? What are the wishes of the committee?
I'd ask that my colleagues, Mr. Chairman, and yourself, of course, accountants themselves they find this acceptable? Is we heard anything otherwise?
No.
Okay. I don't have any other concerns.
No, and I believe I may have done the last sunset extension on this particular one several years ago. It's awfully familiar to me.
Accountants, appraisers.
What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move. I move CS for Senate Bill 129 version /P from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee. Brief at ease. The next item on the calendar today is Senate Bill 159, Air Ambulance Insurance Policies. We first heard this bill on March 17th. During that time, we heard a presentation of the bill and took public testimony. Today, it's my intention to take up the amendment in the members' packets and bring the bill back to the committee for discussion and action. With us today is Christy Jameson, staff to Senator Stedman. Want to give us just a brief wrap-up?
Yes, thank you, Chairman. Passage of Senate Bill 159 would allow all life-saving air medical transport services continue to offer membership programs to residents of Alaska. The purpose of a membership program is to cover all out-of-pocket expenses that may not be covered by a primary payer. Following an organizational restructure last year in 2013, Airlift Northwest membership program was discontinued by the Alaska Division of Insurance. The division deemed their membership program no longer exempt from insurance regulations. Presently, they are allowed to honor existing memberships but cannot allow renewals. SB 159 will exempt all air ambulance services from the state's insurance code, thereby allowing continued membership programs to all Alaskans. Over 3,000 Alaskan residents subscribe and benefit from the membership program. The Division of Elections does not anticipate SB 159 will result in any financial impact to the division. There is zero fiscal note to SB 159. There are several letters of support included in your packet today.
Well, thank you. And I would entertain a motion to adopt the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, to Senate Bill 159, I move amendment N.1.
Is there any opposition? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. Conrad, do you want to explain the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson and the Labor and Commerce Committee. The amendment you have before you, N.1, was brought forward came about by some conversations with some folks that were still expressed just a little bit of concern that we weren't drawing a real bright line on the floor, in the sand, whatever you would like to call it. And this was an attempt to make sure it was very clear that an air ambulance provider or a membership was not otherwise subject to Title 21. It was felt that this may have already been covered, as I said, but this makes it absolutely clear, no questions. And that's it, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you. And for the committee's interest, we do have Laurie Winghire, the Director of the Division of Insurance, in the audience for questions, and Marty Hester, also from the Division. If the committee has any questions for the Division of Insurance. Any questions for Christy?
I'll try just one here. For Christy and perhaps the division in a moment. Christy, can we be confident that, as I understand, one of the main functions of the division is to make sure that things are sufficiently underwritten and that the resource will be there for the insured when the time comes. Is that a concern here, or can we be confident the jet will come when it's called?
I think we can be confident that the jet will come when it's called.
Okay. Thank you.
And as I recall, I believe this Airlift Northwest, the company, the major company in this area, has been around since the late 70s, maybe early 80s. Has some track record. Well, thanks again, Christy.
And thank you very much.
Any questions for the Division of Insurance? I think we talked to them last time, but I think, Marty, you probably have more experience with it, don't you?
Yes,
or you've been working on it longer. How's that?
I'd like to ask just one quick question, if I could.
Sure. Come on up, Marty. Or Mr. Hester, I apologize.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Marty Hester, Deputy Director, Division of Insurance.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Hester, are there other carve-outs like this that aren't subject to the insurance code in the same way that you can think of? And I don't mean any implication that this is a bad idea. I'm just curious.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there's different statutes that deal with different lines of insurance and have different regulations or stipulations on those different lines of insurance. So this would be a particular carve-out for the air ambulance industry. So it wouldn't be apples to apples to say that, you know, a different line or a different type of insurance would have the same type of carve-out or applications as this one would.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions for Mr. Husker? Thanks again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With that, we'll bring it back to the committee. And again, I'd like for the people that are in the room, we've heard this bill previously and taken public testimony on it. Representative Sadler.
Thanks, sir. If you close public testimony, can I have just a brief comment?
Yeah, we closed public testimony after the last, last time.
I just want to say the absence of questions is evidence primarily of the good job we've done vetting this in previous meetings. I've been through this a couple times, so I'm pretty confident in it. So just want to explain the reason for the silence, sir.
Oh.
Thank you. Thank you.
What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 159 as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes or note.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee and we'll take a break at ease. We're back on the record, and the next item on the calendar today is Senate Bill 145, Veterans Retirement Loans, Housing, and Employment. And with us, we have got Commissioner Curtis Thayer. And he's bringing some hired guns. Yes. It'll be Curtis Thayer, Kathy Lee, and Nikki Neal.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Commissioner of the Department of Administration. Kathy Lee is with me, and probably the last time she'll be before a committee on the Hill, Nikki Neal, who is retiring in a couple of weeks. So this is probably...
Congratulations.
Last time up here, hopefully. Before you, you have Senate Bill 145, which is a bill that does some corrective actions or cleanup statutes within the Department of Administration and also with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. The first is that the state of Alaska has hiring preferences for veterans. However, it has not been updated since the Vietnam War. And so what we are requesting here is that the definitions be updated to the federal definition. So our veterans that have served in military conflicts such as the Gulf War, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and all the conflicts since September 11, 2001, we have that hiring preference here for state employees. If you wish to, if you're a veteran and you apply for a job, there's a hiring preference because you are a veteran. The other one is the Veterans Housing Preference section. We have an outdated definition of a veteran, and so it does affect the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And so this just brings our state statutes into alignment with the federal definition already used for public housing and for mortgage loans. And last is the HARD Act, and that is the federal law that was passed in 2008, the Heroes Earnings Assistance and Relief Tax Act. And what this basically does is if you have an employee who is in the military reserve, is called up to duty, goes and is killed in the line of duty, then their health or their life insurance and those benefits would go back to the day that they left state service. And that way their family would be eligible for any type of vesting that they would have had from the time they left state service and they served in the military to the time of their death. And it also allow for them to collect the life insurance benefits. Again, it is a federal requirement. It's something that we as a state are not in compliant with. We have an audit in 2015. And so we would rather be compliant by year 2015. So really, this bill is just cleaning up some veterans statutes and within the Department of Administration.
We've got a pretty good audience. We've got two of the members who are veterans and have taken advantage of programs that are probably better than what's out now. So I think you've got a pretty pretty friendly crowd here. But any questions for Curtis or Nikki? Or Kathy?
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
As before, I don't mean any implication that this isn't a great idea, but what are the costs associated to the last feature where life insurance would be backdated?
There is no fiscal, there's zero fiscal note for all three of these provisions. The reason is luckily as a state, we have not had anybody who was an employee that was called up that had been killed. So actuaries look at their past to help predict your future. Mm-hmm. And so right now it is zero, is what the actuary is predicted to be. And
Through the chair, Commissioner, did you brief us on this earlier in the
session? Yes, I did.
Thank you.
Wow. McHugh, are you going to be talking or signed up? Or?
Well, if you'd like me to answer any questions, Mr.
Chair. And who else do we have? Just you. Welcome back. You haven't been here for a while. But is there any, if not public testimony, is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, anybody online? Close out public testimony.
Mr. Chair. You should get the woman that's retiring on the record so she says goodbye.
Yeah. What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 145. I move Senate Bill 145 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Seeing no opposition, the bill moves out of committee and brief it is. We're back on the record. Last item on the calendar today is Senate Bill 58, Council Insurance on Certain Abandoned Property. Presenting the bill today will be Alita Buss. Senator Egan will probably be joining us when they get off the floor, and if it's like us, it could be in the next 5 minutes or the next 2 hours, so we might as well.
They're on special order, so who
knows? Oh, that's even worse. Please state your name and affiliation on the record, and you have our undivided attention.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Alita Buss, staff to Senator Egan. Senate Bill 58 clarifies that insurance can be canceled when a property owner abandons the property, thereby increasing a hazard covered by the insurance. AS 2136-210 lists allowable reasons for canceling personal insurance, including a grossly negligent act by the insurer that increases a covered hazard and physically changes the insured property that will result in the property becoming uninsurable. As the statute is currently written, it is not clear whether these reasons would include abandonment of the property by the insured. And so that's we're trying to clarify that entire abandonment can merit cancellation of insurance. Homeowners insurance is underwritten based on the property generally being occupied. An abandoned home greatly increases the risk of damage beyond what was contemplated in the insurance contract, including damage caused by vandalism, broken water pipes, and fire. Cancellation of insurance when the property is abandoned is necessary to manage insurance costs for all consumers. So Senate Bill 58 clarifies that insurance on property that has been entirely abandoned can be canceled in Alaska as it can in all other states.
First question, Whip St. Joseph's, and how do I know that?
Alita, how does the statute define abandonment for those like apparently Ms. Neal who might spend part of the year in Arizona?
Sure. Representative Josephson through the chair. Entire abandonment means the property is no longer occupied by the insured as defined by the policy and does not have contents of substantial utility. So if it's a property that is owned by a snowbird, then the fact that they spend their winter south is probably reflected in that policy. And so that's covered. They wouldn't have their insurance canceled.
Probably less of the seasonal use?
Yeah, seasonal use, cabin properties.
Representative Heron.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess it's maybe just so for sort of a conundrum. If they're paying their insurance but they've abandoned it, why is it an abandonment?
Representative Heron through the chair, is your question what means it's abandoned? So, like this case of maybe the pipes are overflowing, or there's no living contents in the house.
No,
probably nobody watching it, or nobody coming by
right
on a regular basis.
Mr. Chairman, the customer is still buying the insurance, still paying the premiums. And so would it be where that's, even though they're paying the premiums, this proposed legislation would say they can still cancel the insurance because there's no, like you've just described?
Sure, Representative Perrin, through the chair. And I think the situation in the House has to be so bad that the insurance company doesn't want, like, wants to cancel the insurance because they're getting money from the premiums, and so it's not in their interest to cancel the policy unless it's a really bad situation. Otherwise, they can just choose not to renew at the end of the year that the policy is up for renewal.
For the committee, we have a representative of the State Farm in the room that will be testifying as soon as we open it up, if that helps. Any further questions? Thanks again.
Okay, thank you.
Sheridan Winters, come on up. We're opening it up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sheldon Winters. I'm State Farm's retained counsel for Alaska. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I have a presentation that I think is going to answer some of your questions, and certainly will be willing to take and try to answer them at the end of the presentation as well. I'll be very brief. I think Ms. Buss actually touched on most of the points. I just kind of wanted to...
Sheldon, if I could interrupt for a minute, we have been joined by the sponsor, Senator Dennis Egan, who is welcome to join us at the table or sit where he is. Please continue.
So first, I guess I would like to just briefly address why this legislation is needed and how it came about, and Ms. Buss alluded to some of this. Insurance policies are written, and the premiums are underwritten based on certain assumptions and requirements. And a homeowner's policy, it's basically that the home is going to be more or less occupied and therefore more or less maintained and monitored. That's going to differ from person to person. On one end of the spectrum, you're going to have somebody who really doesn't maintain it much at all, and someone who is very attentive to that. But within that wide range of spectrum, homeowners are put in the same risk pool, and that's going to be the key to answer the senator or the representative's question. As long as that risk is acceptable, and that means that it's a homeowner who's more or less occupying the property, you're put in the same risk pool that we all are in. Throughout the country, there's really no dispute that when property becomes abandoned, those risks become so great that they weren't contemplated in the insurance policy, and they should not be in the same risk pool that we all participate in. Ms. Buss alluded to vandalism. You know, I mean, 20 degrees below zero in Fairbanks in the middle of winter, if the person abandons the home, the pipes are probably going to freeze, and you're going to have a flood or a fire or something like that.
Those if they haven't been stolen.
Yep, exactly right. The problem is that Alaska statute apparently is not completely clear that property can be, insurance can be canceled. If you look at Senate Bill 58 on page 1, in the current statute, there are actually five specific reasons why insurance can be canceled before the renewal period. So contemplated in our statutes currently, and every statute throughout the country, frankly, there are good grounds for cancellation of insurance. Some of them include, I'm just going to skip down here to number 4, a grossly negligent act or omission by the insured that substantially increases the hazard insured against. And number 5, physical changes in the insured that result in the property becoming uninsurable. Those are pretty broad, actually, and pretty vague. This statute, notably, is not much different than a lot of other states currently. Some other states simply say you can cancel insurance if the hazard increases. Very vague, very broad. Some are more specific and say you can cancel insurance if the property becomes abandoned or vacant, but there is no definition of abandonment or vacant. In all states that we're aware of, and State Farm sells insurance in all states, when the property has become abandoned, we've never had a problem with the divisions of insurance in canceling the insurance. The question was raised in Alaska when State Farm was looking at their policy, making sure their language was consistent, and they saw the statute and approached the division of insurance.
about whether this would allow cancellation of insurance on abandoned property, and the response was simply that Alaska statute is not completely clear, and if you take a strict construction, the answer is no. So we could literally have a situation where somebody walks out, keeps the door open, leaves it abandoned in the middle of the winter, and we could not cancel the insurance. And to answer Representative Heron's question, the reason why it's so important during midterm is, again, you've got to get it. The premium's been paid. It will be returned to the consumer. But it's you've got to get that out of the risk pool because something drastic is going to happen. I want to talk briefly about some of the protections, the practical protections, and the protection in this statute that may help address some of your concerns. Before we look at the statutory language, I think it's important to remember two things, and Ms. Buss alluded to this as well. Your agent, State Farm, and every other insurer is in the business of selling insurance. This is their product. This is what they want to do. It doesn't make a lot of sense that they're going to cancel the insurance. The premium's been paid at the beginning of the year and have to return that insurance premium unless something drastic has happened. Taking a little step further, your local agent probably has your auto insurance and maybe your life insurance as well. He does not want to lose you as a customer. Before we even get into this statutory language, from a practical standpoint, that agent is going to try to reach out to you or somebody and figure out what's going on. Have you really abandoned the home? The second thing that's important to remember before we talk about the language is that, and again, Ms. Buss alluded to this as well, the policy term is 1 year. So at the beginning of a year, the insurance company and the consumer has decided to renew the policy. And then at the end of the 12-month period, the insurance company can cancel it or not renew the policy and doesn't have to rely on this cancellation statute. So, for example, if, let's say, the 10th month or the 11th month, it becomes clear that the property has been abandoned, the insurance company can simply not renew in the other month. What we're really talking about is a 8-9 month period of time where something really drastic, again, happens that requires the insurance company to want to return that policy and get that house out of the risk pool. So going to the language of the statute, we've worked the proposed statute and the proposed number 6. We've worked with the Division of Insurance, with the industry, and with stakeholders, which a couple of years ago was actually the realtors who stood up and really wanted some sideboards on this. And we worked hard over the interim with them and came up with language that, frankly, I hate to talk in absolutes, but I think it's the most restrictive in the country. And basically, it requires entire abandonment, and that itself has two requirements. It can no longer be occupied by the insured as defined in the policy. And we put that language in there to address the seasonal home or the recreational home. If you have a cabin policy, it's not intended that you're occupying it most of the time. So you can't, the insurance company is not going to cancel the policy because the cabin is not being occupied. It also cannot have contents of substantial utility. No state statute that I'm aware of has both those requirements. And this was put in there to basically say not only is it not occupied as intended by the policy, but basically the furniture has to be out. There has to be nothing in there that could be utilized as for the typical homeowner. At that point in time, there's a 30-day notice requirement that's already in the statute, written notice of cancellation. But we added in here, and again, I don't think this is anywhere in the country. If it is, it's one or two places, that the insurer also has to send written notice to any lender of record. Lastly, and we added this language in there, I should correctly say the sponsor did this, but even if all that occurs, the owner or the owner's agent, real estate agent, personal representative, basically anybody can always come back in and say, oh, you made a mistake. We really haven't abandoned it, and we are doing things that are reasonable maintenance and reasonable monitoring so that we can assure that that property is not truly entirely abandoned. And lastly, I'd say I know of no situation, and it's hard for me to imagine that after all that, a piece of property would be improperly canceled. We haven't heard anybody
voiced any such concern, but I will tell you the Division of Insurance has oversight all over all of this, and if there was some rogue reason, they could step in. So that's basically it. In closing, I want to thank the sponsor and the staff. They've worked very hard over a couple of years now. As stated, we've worked with the sponsor stakeholders in the division, and I think we've come up with some very good language. We've gone through, I think, four or five committees now over the last couple of years and just kind of been delayed, and we would really like to see this move along, and I'm available for questions.
Representative Jones, sir.
Sure. Mr. Williams, I think that this is written tightly at this point. How does State Farm treat policies in the event someone has died and their heirs are sort of in the process of moving the house, alienating it, selling it, whatever?
Representative Jones, listen to the chair. I can only talk somewhat anecdotally or hypothetically, but the bottom line is, again, I go back to your agent is almost assuredly going to know what's going on and be in touch with the representative, the personal representative, and that sort of thing, and just addressing the situation as it goes.
Thank you.
And for the committee, we do have Larry Wanghier and Marty Hester still in the room if there are any questions for the division. Mr. Winters,
is the division. Mr. Winters, thank you, through the chair, Mr. Winters. I have to ask, on page 2, line 6, it says entire abandonment of the property. That increases a hazard insured against, which restricts that entire abandonment. I have to ask, is there any kind of entire abandonment that would not increase a hazard insured against? I mean, usually a homeowner's coverage covers almost everything. There's a long list of coverage. I just had to ask what it might not cover.
Yeah. Representative Sandler, you're right, is the bottom line, but we just, again, we wanted to make this as restrictive as possible and just satisfy anybody, so we put both those in there.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thanks again, Mr. Winters. Any questions for the Division of Insurance?
Do I declare a conflict? I have a home insurance to State Farm.
You're in safe hands. No, that's the other thing.
You're there, though.
Let's see, is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, and how about online? Hearing none, public testimony is over. And what is the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 58 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Seeing no opposition, the bill is so moved. And we will adjourn at 4:30.